This is Intercom Feedback Loop. I am your host, Chase Hendrickson, and welcome you to this Journal Club podcast series brought to you by Endocrine Society. Thanks for joining us as we explore an important article recently published in one of the Society's clinical journals. Hello and welcome back to the Endocrine Feedback Loop podcast for our 33rd episode. For this episode of the podcast, we return to the JCENM, this time to look at a report comparing outcomes from GLP-1 receptor agonist and SGLT2 inhibitor use in individuals with type 1 diabetes. This is an unsettled question in clinical care, so additional data here may help guide how we treat our patients. This is another observational study, so we will need to do our usual careful consideration of the methodology as that may affect the conclusions drawn from the results. I host the Endocrine Feedback Loop podcast and work at the Vanderbilt University Medical Center in Nashville, Tennessee, where I am a general endocrinologist, the medical director for our endocrinology clinics, and an associate director for our fellowship program. I'm excited today to have two well-known diabetologists join me for this episode of the podcast. Ashok Balasubramanian returns today as our regular contributor for this month. He works at the Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas, where he is a vice president and also a senior associate dean for their medical school and the director of their clinical scientist training program. He is well known for his own translational research in diabetes, as well as being the chair of the endocrinology specialty board for the ABIM. David Nathan joins us today as our guest expert for this month. He comes to us from the Harvard Medical School and the Massachusetts General Hospital, where he directs the Diabetes Center and the Clinical Research Center. He is one of the world's experts in clinical care for people with diabetes and one of the leading researchers in diabetes, having helmed work for the DCCT, EDICT, and DPP. In sum, quite the auspicious pair of endocrinologists join me today to review this article. As always, everything we say will be our opinions only and not those of the Endocrine Society or of our respective institutions. Today, we review clinical and safety outcomes for GLP-1 receptor agonists and SGLT2 inhibitors in type 1 diabetes, a real-world study. This paper is forthcoming in the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism from the University of Texas Southwestern, with Kari Edwards and Zilong Li as the first authors. At this point, I'll turn things over to Ashok. He will go through the author's introduction, both touching on some of the key points that they make and reviewing, along with David, some important concepts that we need to be keeping in mind. Ashok?
Thank you, Chase, and welcome, David. So the background to this interesting paper is that, you know, we're a few decades along from the landmark Diabetes Control and Complications trial, which was, in fact, led by David. And, you know, we've learned a lot of lessons from then, and there have been tremendous improvements in insulin delivery technology during that time. So one would expect, if anything, that glycemic control might be easier or better among patients with type 1 diabetes. But in fact, it looks as though the trends are quite the opposite. Glycemic control remains suboptimal for a majority of patients with type 1 diabetes. And the question is, what are the additional kinds of treatments or managements we can provide? And I'd like to pause for a second and ask David for his perspective. Why is it, do you think, David, that control has not gotten absolutely perfect since the decades after the DCCC?
Well, thanks, Ashok. So I would point out first that it's difficult. There's a real challenge, and it involves a lot of work, effort on the part of patients, a lot of effort on the part of their endocrinologists, diabetes experts. You know, I'm more of a glass half full person. And I must say that compared to when we started the DCCT, when the mean A1C levels, for example, nationwide were in the mid-9s, so that there has been enormous progress since then, with median A1Cs now, true, not everyone's getting an A1C less than 7, and by the way, not everyone should get an A1C less than 7, but for those in whom it is an appropriate goal, not all of them are achieving it, but it is improving, and it's a moving target. My prediction is that with the new methodologies that are available, closed-loop pumps or semi-automated pumps, the use of continuous glucose monitoring, that it's going to improve. Whether adjunctive therapy, in fact, has benefits that outweigh their risks and expense is, I think, part of what we'll be discussing today.
Thanks, David. Those are all key points. The other thing which actually the authors bring out is there's been a secular trend in populations during all of this time. And one of the things is the fact that everyone is getting more overweight and obese, and therefore people with type 1 diabetes are also having a greater prevalence of obesity, which adds another layer of insulin resistance and abnormal adipose function to the complex metabolic defects they already have. In addition, cardiovascular risk is also quite high. So just again, pause for a second and ask both Chase and David, in your practices, what do you think is happening in terms of these additional overlays in patients with type 1 diabetes? How much do you think that adds to their complications?
I might weigh in here and just say from a conundrum that I'm faced with a lot, I'd say this is a question that comes up in my mind because I have patients who, yes, control has improved over the decades, but often have a lot of people who are not quite where I want them to be, but they are overweight or obese. And so as they're approaching me and we talk about increasing insulin and they're asking questions like, but do you think I might gain weight with that? And I think, well, there is a good chance that you may continue to gain weight, particularly if I am increasing the insulin that you're receiving, or getting asked questions by my nephrology colleagues and cardiology colleagues saying, hey, this person has CKD, this person has had a cardiac event, should we be doing more than just trying to get their diabetes under better control? So I know this is a question that gets asked of me a lot, and is one of the reasons that this paper caught my eye, because it comes up so frequently, and it's something that we have a little bit of information on, but not a lot. So I think that that's a pretty important thing for us to keep in mind.
I might add to that that we used to think of type 1 diabetes as skinny young people, and as has been pointed out, that is no longer the case. And in fact, the body mass of people with type 1 diabetes now is very similar to that of the U.S. population. And the reason for that, of course, is that intensive therapy, controlling their glucose levels, their A1C levels, closer to the non-diabetic range, has allowed them to gain weight when they overeat, which unfortunately it appears most of us are doing. I should also point out, however, that we knew this back in the DCCT. So the people in the intensive treatment group gained weight compared to those in the conventional treatment group. They did benefit from the intensive therapy regardless of their weight gain. Would they have done even better if they hadn't gained weight? It's impossible to say that. But in fact, the benefits in terms of microvascular disease and ultimately cardiovascular disease occurred in the setting of them gaining weight, but with their A1C at 7 instead of at 9.
So certainly new complications in the treatment of patients with type 1 diabetes. So this is where the authors ask the question, can the newer classes of glucose-lowering agents, the GLP-1 receptor agonists and the SGLT2 inhibitors, do they have any role in the better treatment of patients with type 1 diabetes? Both obviously are really excellent at glucose-lowering. They also have a number of other really important beneficial effects. Both of them promote weight loss and decrease the risk of cardiovascular events. And the SGLT2 inhibitors also decrease the rate of progression to CKD, which is a tremendous advance just in the field of renal failure. But these have not been investigated in prospective large trials of type 1 diabetes patients. And the smaller RCTs in these patients have emphasized more their adverse effects rather than the benefits, and the adverse effects being predominantly hypoglycemia and the risk of ketoacidosis amongst those taking SGLT2 inhibitors. So given the difficulties in achieving glycemic control with insulin regimens alone, and given all of these temporal changes in the type 1 phenotype, it appears that physicians generally have been quite commonly using these two classes of agents in an off-label way, using it as adjuvant therapy for patients with type 1 diabetes. And they're probably doing this both in the hopes of optimizing glycemic control and also in the hopes of reducing patients' weight and stabilizing their renal function and for the cardiovascular benefits and so forth. So with all of this in mind, the authors of this paper were looking to see if they could determine the efficacy and long-term safety of the GLP-1 receptor agonists and SGLT2 inhibitors in type 1 diabetes patients in what they call a real-world setting. And this was done over a retrospective review of a median of about 29 months of treatment. Chase?
Ashok, thank you. I think you and David have set up really nicely here for this paper, and I think it have created a really compelling situation that we want to understand more here. There's great potential here, but we don't really know what to do. So I think that helps us think about this and why we want more information in this space. So the first thing that we're going to do is we're going to think about the study design that you use here, and this is what we normally do. So we'll take a bit of a step back and talk about retrospective cohort studies in general, and then we'll dive into this study and see how the authors, the investigators, use that study design here. So just as a reminder, with retrospective cohort studies, what makes a study a cohort study is if you have a group of individuals, and we'll see what this is, it's a specific form of folks with type 1 diabetes. So if you've got a group of folks and then you have one subgroup in there that is exposed to something, and then you have another group, and traditionally it's a group that's unexposed, or alternatively, and this is relevant for us today, it could be a different exposure, but you've at least got two subgroups in that cohort, and then you're able to follow these individuals individuals over time. So the time component is key. That's what makes it a cohort study. And you're looking for development of outcome or outcomes that are different in the exposed group versus the unexposed or the group with a different exposure. What makes it retrospective is that you start the study after all of the data has been collected. So you're not following these folks in real time. It's after everything is done. Not only the exposures have occurred, but also all of the outcomes have occurred. That's when you start your study. And so you're collecting that data. So there are a few pros and cons that I think are particularly relevant here. And one of them, and the authors point this out, Ashok's used the term already, as the authors do, that it's real world data. And I think that's helpful. That is usually used as a contrast to clinical trials. David is an expert in clinical trials, and so he could speak to this, but it's well known, well recognized that many of the individuals who participate in clinical trials as the subjects are often not very well representative of the population at large. They're a unique subset. And while we learn a lot, there may be some limitations in trying to generalize that to an entire population of individuals with a certain disease. So that's often the purported advantage of saying this is real world, is there's a little bit less of that. There is, however, a big con that you have to think about that is substituted there. So in clinical trials, individuals are randomized to whether they receive one treatment or another, or a placebo as opposed to a treatment. And that is in contrast to clinical care, where people are given medications intentionally. And with that, there's often very, very good reasons for that. It's a good intentionality, but you have to understand when it's being analyzed, when we're looking at it, you have to recognize that these folks were not randomly selected, that there was a reason that these medications were chosen. And that may be a big driver of the outcomes that we see. It may not be at least only the medication that we're looking at, but it may be some of these other drivers that led to a medication being used that is actually causing the outcome. So we're going to think about that selection bias, as it's termed. Okay, so those are retrospective cohort studies in general. Now let's look at this study and see how the authors set it up using that design. So this is a retrospective cohort study, and the cohorts, the group of subjects as a whole, included individuals with type 1 diabetes, and it had to be people, type 1 diabetes, who were given either a GLP-1 receptor agonist or an SGLT2 inhibitor as adjunct therapy. So obviously type 1 diabetes, they were all on insulin. So it was in addition to their insulin therapy. And this was looking at a single academic institution. So this is UT Southwestern in Dallas, Texas. And the way the author set this up, and I want us to think a little bit more about this in a second here. I'll ask David for his thoughts on this. But they don't look to have one group who is treated and then another group who is untreated. They have two treated groups. So one of the groups in this cohort is those who were treated with GLP-1 receptor agonist. And then the other group are individuals who were treated with SGLT2 inhibitors. And those two groups are going to be compared, and we'll look at that here in a second. And one of the reasons that this caught my eye is because I think often when I'm seeing these patients and I'm looking at this data, trying to see how does this apply to the patients that I see, I don't find myself typically saying, I'm going to start one of these, which one should I choose, and trying to compare. It's trying to say, should I add an SGLT2 inhibitor or should I not add something? Should I add a GLP-1 receptor agonist or should I not add that? And so we don't have that group of nothing was added, that true control group of where usual care with insulin only was provided. So there's reasons for doing that, but any thoughts that you had in particular about that study design, and particularly how the groups are set up there?
I want to point out at the outset that I'm a data snob. I've spent my life doing experimental studies, randomly assigned therapies, following people with rigid methods that are consistent over time. And frankly, I was a little surprised at the selection of this. I understand how appealing real-world data are. And it is true, by the way, that, as you noted, experimental designs and studies at academic centers are not always representative. There are all kinds of problems. When the volunteers, the first are volunteers, they tend to have a higher socioeconomic status. They have higher IQs than the average population. They look different. Okay, so there is that problem. On the other hand, there's a rigid approach and a rigorous approach, rigid and rigorous, to the collection of the data, the conduct of the study. And to me, these kinds of real-world studies contribute only a little bit, and they are almost never compelling, especially when they're as small as the one that we're looking at here. We're talking about 104, 108 patients who are studied here over a modest period of time, and I just don't find these kinds of data to be very helpful, frankly, in making the decisions, especially in the setting where there are dozens of studies now on SGLT2s and GLP-1 agonists in the setting of type 1 diabetes. none of them long enough, none of them large enough to look at the issues of harm, for example. But this study is certainly way too small and too brief to look at benefit with regard to cardiovascular or renal disease, for example. There were no significant differences. But anyway, so I have a generally a negative view of these kinds of studies, and I'll just point that out at the beginning. That said, I think we should look, as you've suggested, at what it does, what are the insights it provides with regard to these drugs.
Good. So that's a really helpful preview. So we're going to think about that. I think those are all really important things. And a lot of what David said already is true for almost any type of observational study. That is baked into a lot of that. Those are things that authors have to grapple with, is intrinsic limitations to observational data. So we're going to think about that carefully. And then we're going to do exactly what he's alluded to already. We're going to think about some of that other literature that's out there already. The authors do a nice review of that in their conclusion, in their discussion. So we're going to think about that more when we get there. Okay. So back to this study, the patient identification. So what these investigators did is they used their electronic health record to do a query to find everybody with type 1 diabetes, and that was based on ICD-10 codes or ICD-9 prior to that. And then they looked to see if those individuals had ever been prescribed a GLP-1 receptor agonist or an SGLT-2 inhibitor. And then what the authors did is they did a manual review of all of those individuals' charts to validate them. So that was both to confirm the diagnosis of type 1 diabetes as opposed to some other type of diabetes, and also that they had in fact used the medication, that it wasn't just a prescription that was never followed by actual use of the medication. There was also other data that could not be extracted automatically, and so that had to be manual. Extracted as well. So the population that they identified with that, so they wanted to look at only adults. So these were individuals who were 18 or older at the time of that medication use. And there were a few exclusions that the authors used. So if the individuals transferred their care, so if they had ongoing care received outside of UT Southwestern, they were excluded. If there was incomplete data, if that manual review called into question the diagnosis of type 1 diabetes, those folks were excluded. And then also if there was unclear medication use, that was the final reason for exclusion. And just a couple of comments on the data that was collected. So Shoksha in a second here is going to walk us through the results. So important as a definition from the baseline, there's a lot of comparisons after medicine has started to the baseline. So the way the investigators defined baseline was 90 days before medication was started, including up to 14 days afterwards. So that was that period. Anything in there would count as the baseline period. And then they collected the data, all of those variables, up through the end of October 2021. And with the analysis, so there's a few different comments I think that are helpful here. One of them is that they looked at a lot of data, and some of it was recurring over time. I think just as an example, the A1C is probably the best example of that. And so when they had recurring data, they grouped that into 3-month intervals. And then Ashok's going to walk us through. And so that's how that was analyzed with that grouping. And finally, the authors planned on a couple of subgroups up front. So they wanted to see if it was different based on the baseline A1C, so prior to when either of these agents were started, and also see if effects were different based on the baseline weight, again, prior to medications being started. So that's just a quick overview of the methodology there. I'll now turn it over to Ashok. He's going to walk us through these results. And then after that, we'll come back and try to put this in context and think about the discussion. But Ashok, why don't you walk us through those results now?
Yeah, thanks, Chase. So it ended up that from their review, about 104 patients were included who'd used one or the other of these agents. 62 had taken a GLP-1 RA, the majority on liraglutide, and 28 had taken SGLT2 inhibitors, the majority on empagliflozin, and 11 had tried both agents in the 90-day window around this the entry criteria. And they were predominantly white patients, 90%, and the majority also were on some sort of continuous insulin delivery method or a pump. Now, in terms of selection of these patients, again, how rigorously do you do that retrospectively? But it turns out that a much greater proportion of those in the SGLT2 group had albuminuria or heart failure at baseline, suggesting that there was a bit of a selection bias given the benefits that are accruing to SGLT2s. And conversely, many more patients, 50% more in the GLP-1 group, had an episode of DKA before starting therapy, again, suggesting that, you know, the physicians were cautious about putting an SGLT2 onto anyone with a prior history of DKA. to the extent they could glean from the records, they tried to figure out why these patients were tried on adjuvant therapy. And the reasons include weight loss, trying to get better glycemic control, trying to decrease insulin requirements. And for a small fraction, actually, the primary reason appeared to be risk reduction, either cardiovascular or progression of kidney disease. There were also a number of patients in whom the adjuvant therapy was stopped. And the reasons for that were primarily side effects. So about 25% of people in both groups ended up having some sort of drug-stopping side effect. There were also issues with insurance denial, pregnancy in a small proportion, and the incidence of DKA is worth noting. It was 6.7% for those who were taking an SGLT2 inhibitor and 1.9% for those in a GLP-1 receptor agonist, which is sort of expected given what we know about these agents. Now, in terms of the efficacy outcomes, there was a slight and statistically significant change over the baseline A1C in both groups. So it went down from 7.9% to 7.3% after 12 months of usage for the GLP-1 group, and from 7.7% to 7.3% after 12 months on the SGLT2 inhibitors. So there was a small but significant change from baseline in both groups, but the two groups were not different in regard to the delta of the change. There was also an interesting change in weight loss, and basically there was significantly greater weight loss in the GLP-1 group than in the SGLT2 inhibitor group. The GLP-1 group went down from a mean of 90.4 kilograms to 85.4, so pretty much a 5 kilogram weight loss on average, and a much smaller weight loss of about maybe 2 kilograms on average in the SGLT2 inhibitor group, and those differences between the groups was significant. They also looked at insulin requirements in terms of the total daily dose of insulin taken by these patients, and there was a drop. Total daily insulin went down from 61 or about 62 units total to about 50 units total over 12 months for the GLP-1 agonist group, and this included reductions in both basal and bolus doses, whereas for the SGLT2 inhibitor group, the drop was smaller, and it was really only significant in the bolus dose and not in the basal insulin dose. There were also some greater drops in insulin requirements amongst those who had a higher A1C and lower weighted baseline. And we could actually pause and ask the question, why might that be? Why would the greater drop in insulin requirement happen among those who started off with a higher A1C or a lower weight? Any conclusions anyone draws from these changes in total daily dose drops?
I must say that I can't draw any specific conclusions from them. I'm not sure how important it is, frankly.
One thing that I would add when we're thinking about those baseline differences there, so David commented already on the baseline of the insulin differences there, and then also the change. I thought it was interesting to think about the baseline of the A1C. The focus here is always going to be on what the change was, what the improvement that may be related to the medications was. I thought it was worth noting, particularly since I was really thinking about how much of a selection bias might be at play here, is to think that, you know, overall, while the A1Cs weren't at goal on average, they were in the 7. So this wasn't a group of folks who had horribly controlled diabetes that people were just trying something to see if it might help. And I think it's particularly important then when we're thinking about side effects, and we're going to think a lot more about that. Ashok mentioned some of the risk, particularly around DKA already, is that this is a group of folks who are, you would say, are probably pretty consistently taking their insulin here if their A1Cs are in the 7. So this isn't a group of folks with A1Cs in the double digits that these medications are being tried for, at least on average.
And these results mirror the results of a dozen or so clinical trials of these agents in type 1 diabetes. So, those results are not surprising to me, at least. Mm-hmm. The question is, what more does it actually add?
Absolutely. Well, let's see if it adds anything further in terms of other benefits, because beyond the glycemic changes, they look particularly at things like the renal outcomes and lipids and so forth. And interestingly, because I think this was something people were looking out for, is that there was no significant change in the estimated GFR or in the urinary albumin to creatinine ratio compared to baseline. There are a lot of reasons you can deduce from that, the duration of the study, et cetera, but it was in fact no difference. Now, does this mean that it was at least somewhat beneficial in keeping things stable, or was it simply not able to assess its efficacy because there was no decrease? It's hard to say. We don't have a standard care group, obviously, to look at, so we really have no idea what this means. But at least at face value, it doesn't look like there was anything significant happening on the renal side. As far as lipids were concerned, there was a pretty dramatic and significant reduction in both total cholesterol and LDL cholesterol after 12 months of the GLP-1 agonist, for instance, going down from a mean of 104 milligrams per deciliter down to 77 on mean, which is a pretty striking and significant drop. Again, not unexpected. But in the SGLT2 inhibitors, there was no particular change. David, what is your thought about this? Of course, we don't know if lipid-lowering medications were added to anybody because this is all retrospective, but assuming that was not a big confounder, is this something you'd expect?
So you're right. It's a little hard to figure out what this means without knowing what the concurrent medication changes were over time. But this is not the lipid changes, especially looking at triglyceride liver synthesis, VLDL particles. It has been recognized as a benefit of GLPs in the past in the type 2 population. So it doesn't surprise me that lipids became less atherogenic during the treatment, even independent, by the way, of weight loss sometimes. So GLP has a number of different effects on lipid synthesis, some direct, some indirect. So no, it didn't surprise me.
So that was it in terms of the sort of a summary of the efficacy outcomes, a slight improvement in both groups in terms of A1C, starting with a not very high baseline, some changes in insulin requirements, really no change in renal parameters, and at least for GLP-1, a pretty significant drop in LDL and total cholesterol. Now, in terms of safety, which is probably very hard to assess in this kind of a study, there were some numbers worth looking at. So the incidence of DKA, for instance, which is something we always think about, it was significantly higher in the patients on SGLT2 inhibitors. 12.8% of patients in that group experienced an episode of DKA compared to about 4% in those taking the GLP-1 receptor agonist. And interestingly, the majority of these people were experiencing some kind of a change in their pump regimen. Either they were experiencing pump failure or they were transitioning from one kind of a pump to another. And it's well known that it's during these times that one is most likely to have drastic changes in glycemic control or in metabolic complications. But that kind of bears out what we kind of already know about SGLT2 inhibitors and the so-called euglycemic DKA. There was hardly any hypoglycemia or pancreatitis was absent in this group. They give some numbers in regard to hospitalizations, which generally seem fairly low. Interestingly, in terms of ER visits, the SGLT2 inhibitor group had it over the GLP-1 group. For the GLP-1 group, there were about 14 ER visits over 100 patient years versus only 3 for the SGLT2 inhibitors. And one wonders if any of that has to do with acute side effects of the GLP-1 receptor agonists, you know, abdominal issues and so forth. So I guess I'll pause at this point and maybe get the group's thoughts, Chase, on these findings, both in terms of, you know, efficacy and in terms of side effects. So what do you all think?
Yeah, I might comment just a little bit. I keep coming back to the selection bias, but I think it's something you want to think about here. I think really the DKA one is helpful because in this group, again, this is not random allocation of medications to folks. It's being really selectively given to individuals. And I think this would come into play with DKA. Ashok mentioned it already, but this concern about DKA with euglycemic DKA, primarily in folks with type 2 diabetes, but then I think concern about that in a type 1 population is going to be very well known to people who provide care for folks with diabetes. So endocrinologists know about this. So I think we would have to assume that there's going to be a lot of hesitancy about using such an agent in individuals who say have a history of repeated episodes of DKA. We don't know that for sure, but this is the sort of thing that you have to think about with a selection bias. So I think it's important to note that even with that increase in DKA, this is likely a group that was pre-selected to have a relatively low risk of that. Clinical trials, David talked to us about already, is going to be the most motivated, compliant, to use a bit of an old-fashioned word there, but folks are going to be very adherent to their medications. This is going to be a little bit closer. It's described as real world, so it's going to be a little bit closer to the average population that we see in clinic, but I think because of that selection bias, it's still not a perfect representation. I think the risk, again, conjecture, but I think it's likely going to be higher than this if we thought about a population at large.
So I might just remind the audience that the clinical trials that were conducted with empagliflozin, canagliflozin, dapagliflozin, sotagliflozin, which is the joint SGLT1 and 2, selected their participants carefully to reduce the risk of DKA. They couldn't have had a history of DKA in the previous year. They were not vulnerable. They took their medications carefully. In addition, the majority of them, if not all of them, supplied the participants in these studies with the ability to measure their ketones at home. They supplied them with urine keto sticks or beta hydroxybutyrate sticks for them to measure. And even with that, in those controlled clinical trials, the risk of DKA was increased by threefold or fourfold. As you point out, Chase, I think appropriately, one would hope that clinicians understanding that risk would have pre-selected these patients when they were going to give them this adjunctive therapy with at least an SGLT2, also to select for people who are reasonably safe and who took care of themselves well and who didn't miss insulin, whatever. And the higher rate of DKA, and again, the numbers are tiny here. You know, the participant numbers are tiny. But even here, though, the rate per 100 patient years was higher than in the controlled clinical trials, suggesting that even careful clinicians, I'm going to assume that the clinicians in Texas were trying to be careful, but even with that care and selection of patients to treat these patients with, DKA is a real risk. I've been quite outspoken about this. I wrote an editorial in the New England Journal a while back. I participated in some national debates about this, and I just don't get it. I don't get how we would use these drugs, frankly, when even under the best of circumstances, DKA risk is increased, and the benefits, which we'll turn to in a minute, I think, have yet to be demonstrated in terms of heart and kidney.
So David's already got us thinking about this weighing of risk benefit. So we're going to keep on thinking about that, and we'll transition now into the discussion. So first of all, I'm going to review a few of the findings that the author summarized for us. And I think the first one was helpful. David mentioned already, we want to be thinking here, well, we have clinical trials. What does this in particular add that we didn't know already? And the authors do start with something that I think at least gives us a little bit of insight into prescriber behavior. So that's something that clinical trials can't tell us as much about. So this is when they look at the charts and say, well, why are these agents being prescribed? At least what's in the chart and the notes for these individuals, these patients, as to why these different agents are being started. So at least according to the documentation, in particular, the GLP-1 receptor agonists, those are being started for weight loss and improved glycemic control. So those are the two big ones that stuck out there. A few more with the SGLT2 inhibitors, and that's improved glycemic control. So that's in common, but also reduced insulin dose, as mentioned. And then yet another one that we haven't really talked about here is reduced glucose variability. So we'll come back to that in a second, but that's at least a part of a documented reason, a rationale for providers starting agents like that. So the changes that we see, I'm going to summarize this, the author summarized it, and Ashok walked us through the details of this. But again, with the GLP-1s, what we see with that in this group is improved A1Cs, lower weight, lower amounts of insulin, and some lipid improvements. And then in SGLT2 inhibitors, we see also an improved A1Cs, and then some improvements in amount of, or at least a reduction in amount of insulin, though it's specific for basal insulin here. And then as we've talked about already, and we're going to keep thinking about, there was more DKA in those who were started on an SGLT2 inhibitor. So now, I mentioned this before, but the authors do take a step back and they do compare their own data to other data, so both other observational data and clinical trial data. But that was in particular for type 1. So I'm going to summarize that here for us in just a second. Where I thought it might be helpful for us to also think about is what the data shows in type 2. There's a lot of data here in folks with type 2 diabetes, and so I'm going to not do that myself. I'll ask David to give us a quick, just a high-level overview of when we think about these agents in type 2, where we're using them a lot. What's the data? Give us an overview of the impact that we expect with these two agents in folks with type 2 diabetes.
Well, the lowering of hemoglobin A1C, which is the metric by which FDA initially judges these agents, is pretty clear. The GLPs have gone progressively, as we all know, from twice a day injections to once a day to once a week. And some of the more recent agents, and especially the GLP-GIP combination, a tirzepatide recently approved, really have a pretty substantial effect on hemoglobin A1C in type 2 diabetes. And the ADA views them as being kind of in parallel early on. You don't necessarily have to start someone whose A1C starts at 9 or 9 plus on insulin. You can actually try a GLP, one of the more powerful, more recent generation GLP analogs, for example. With regard to the other side effects, of course, the weight loss is the one that caught everyone's interest when the GLPs were first introduced, accompanied, of course, as we all know, by a 20 to 40% incidence of GI side effects, depending on whether the company runs the study or academics do, rapidly go away or a little less rapidly. But in this paper, similarly, even though the population is small, it was about 20% stopped using the drug because of GI side effects or something to that effect. in this current paper, it's similar to the type 2 results. The big difference, of course, is that the benefits that were demonstrated, not because pharma wanted to demonstrate them, but because starting in 2008, the FDA required all new diabetes drugs to have secondary safety studies. But the real benefits here of these two drugs, which are now being used more often by kidney specialists and heart specialists than us maybe, is that, of course, they do have a beneficial effect on heart disease, especially in people with prior heart disease or at high risk for heart disease, and on kidney, especially for the SGLT2s. And then the SGLT2s also working as kind of a diuretic also have a benefit with regard to congestive heart failure. So those benefits, with only a modest increase in DKA with SGLT2s in the type 2 diabetes population, but those benefits clearly outweigh the risk. And we are all now taking a kind of a detour, if you will, at the very beginning in talking with type 2 diabetes, if they have those conditions where these drugs are being used to protect their heart, protect their kidney, we tend to use those preferentially. The results with regard to A1C, as I said, GLPs are pretty powerful. SGLT2s, by contrast, are actually pretty weak, depending as they do on the ability to excrete a lot of glucose in the urine. And as patients get older, as their filtration rates fall, they just don't filter as much glucose and they can't put out as much glucose in the urine any longer. I mean, that's the brief rundown on their effects in type 2 diabetes.
Yeah, an excellent overview and exactly why I ask you to do that as opposed to doing it myself. So that set us up really nicely here. We're going to come back to that, particularly those cardiac and renal benefits. We're going to circle back to those here in just a second. So now what the authors do here, because they really focus their comparison on folks with type 1 diabetes, so not the type 2 effects that David just walked us through. So they point out that their real world results are fairly similar to other real world data that's out there, though there's not a lot of that. Then they compared under the RCT. So that's come up over and over again. And they point out that with the GLP-1, so in particular, they looked at the adjunct studies that looked at liraglutide, that they're very similar results to what they found in this real world data versus that RCT. They did say there was a little bit less of a difference in the clinical trials looking at SGLT2 inhibitors, is that those RCTs showed some weight loss and they were not able to demonstrate that in their study. So similar other than that. Now, side effects, we're going to think more about those here. So we talked about this several times already, but in particular the DKA. So the SGLT2 inhibitors had about four times as much DKA, and that's despite at baseline having less DKA than the folks who were eventually started on GLP-1s. And they pointed out here, we talked about this, that those rates of DKA in the SGLT2 inhibitors were higher than had been reported in the RCTs, and we've talked a little bit about why that might be the case. Finally, with hypoglycemia, they said there was very little reported hypoglycemia. Maybe not surprising, though, this isn't something that was systematically collected. And so it may be occurring quite a bit, but wasn't documented, maybe wasn't asked about in the first place. So likely missing quite a bit of that here. All right, David, so we're going to circle back to you. You've mentioned the side effect things already, and I think we do want to spend some time thinking about this. So as we think about this, in particular, thinking about these medications for our patients, we're going to get to potential benefits here in a second. But as far as the side effects go, how do you think about it? You mentioned you have strong feelings already. So how do you think about these side effects in particular for folks with type 1 diabetes?
I think I would start with the GLPs. I mean, discuss the drugs separately. So as in this study, I think that most of us who consider using a GLP agonist in a patient with type 1 diabetes is owing to their effects on weight loss. The reduction in insulin dose to me is slightly irrelevant, I must say. The lowering of the A1C is modest. And for both of these drugs, by the way, we should clearly recognize that the pharma-supported clinical trials that go only 6 months always show a magnified effect, whereas the studies that go a year show the A1C lowering actually shrinking over time. But I think it's fair to say that when we think about using GLPs in our type 1 population, it is almost always in concert with the weight center, which we may refer them to. And these are the folks who are big enough where we're actually thinking about whether they should have weight loss bariatric surgery procedures done. And the GLPs in them are moderately effective, as they've been everywhere else. I mean, you know, we should be clear. Every endocrinologist has a patient who's gone on a GLP, usually with type 2 diabetes, who loses 35 pounds. But in fact, the data are pretty clear, even idealized data in clinical trials. One of the problems with clinical trials is that the data may be somewhat idealized. But in the studies, people lose 5 to 8 pounds with the first generation of the GLPs, with the more powerful ones, semaglutide, for example, maybe 10 to 12 pounds, even over the course of a year. And as I said, tirzepatide seems to be really quite remarkable in terms of greater weight loss. So I think that thinking about these agents with type 1 diabetes, GLPs, especially given that they don't have that much baggage, the major baggage that they carry is the GI side effects, which have been seen. I started doing GLP research back in the early 1980s. And the first thing I remember is giving a patient GLP intravenously, the real thing. And as I cranked up the rate, they leaned over the side of the gurney and threw up on my shoes. So that is just something that is part of GLPs. Other than that, though, however, they really are pretty generally safe. And even after a while, the newer ones, you know, the weekly injections, well tolerated. So I think that for weight loss, we think about that. As I've mentioned before, for the SGLT2s, I don't think about them at all. Because I think that this risk decay is not that common, but it's more common with them. I have told of an episode of decay that was even fatal in a patient treated with an SGLT2. And I just don't get it. I don't get what the benefit there is that overweighs the, you know, it's primum non nocere. First, do no harm is what I think about for these drugs, especially when you're using them off label, which is what this is.
Thank you. That's really helpful. Ashok, comments?
Yeah, I had a question for David. I want to draw on your expertise, David. So I don't want to be drawn into the semantic argument about what's type 1 versus type 2 diabetes over here. But let's just say that the value of an SGLT2 inhibitor is, as you've expressed it, in terms of glycemic control and increasing side effects, gets worse and worse as you have less and less endogenous insulin secretory function. And that group includes a lot of people who started off life as some kind of type 2 diabetic, but now they're losing insulin secretion quite significantly. Many of our patients do this. Or they have an atypical form of diabetes and they simply start off with low reserve. But, you know, on the chart and in the clinic, for most physicians, they're just called type 2 diabetes, right? And so when we start giving these drugs to people just because they're called type 2 diabetes, we're also ignoring people at the end of the scale who are losing beta cell function, have very little left, are already on insulin, et cetera. So what kind of guidelines should we have around that in terms of the risk benefit?
I won't have the temerity to suggest an answer when you are one of the leading experts in the world on the crossover, the confusion, this crudity of labeling people as type 1, type 2. When in fact, what I think you're pointing out is that people with type 2 can have profound levels of insulin deficiency, whether they're autoimmune or not. And as your work has pointed out, many of them probably do have some, you know, there are enough of them with autoimmune characteristics, even though they're not clearly labeled as type 1, that they may be at risk. And it may well be that when we see DKA in the setting of, quote, type 2 diabetes, that in fact, what we're talking about is that our appreciation of the underlying pathophysiology remains quite crude. So I think that puts people at, quote, type 2 diabetes potentially at risk. Should we be screening them? And some studies, by the way, I think have actually done fairly rudimentary measurements, but have, you know, tried to measure how insulin deficient volunteers in these studies are. But I think that's just a general warning. I agree with you completely.
Right. Now, I'm just wondering if in the near future, we might try to make that a little more precise. These drugs are going to be used left and right, particularly with the whole issue of renal protection in patients with type 2 diabetes, for instance. I'm wondering if there's going to be room at some point for testing whether, looking at the duration of your diabetes, some kind of a score based on your complications, maybe a C-peptide level, might some of these influence your decision, you know, to use these agents given the risks that you talked about?
I agree with you. They may be used in the future. Right now, keep in mind that the SGLT2s are being used by nephrologists right and left. They may inform us that they've treated our patient with an SGLT2, but it's not like we're going to be doing that from the very onset.
Correct.
They will be initiating those drugs.
So let's think about that a little bit more. We've talked already here about some of those risks. Now we need to get to the other side of that and think about the benefits. So we've talked already about the weight loss that we see with GLP-1s. So we've covered that. I would like us to think more about the SGLT2 inhibitors in particular with the cardiac and renal benefit that's there, though that's likely shared with the GLP-1s as well. And ask David here one final question on this. So we know a lot from the folks with type 2. You reviewed that data already. When we think about folks with type 1, we don't have much information here. So how should we be thinking about this? Should we just say we don't know, so we shouldn't assume anything? Or should we say these medicines likely are going to be beneficial regardless of the type of diabetes, so we're likely getting a benefit even though we don't know for sure? How do you think about the uncertainty here?
Well, the first thing is that I would suggest that the population with type 1 diabetes, writ large, of course, includes a broader distribution across younger age groups, where in fact, they're going to have less overall risk for cardiovascular disease. So initiating, 20-year-olds and 30-year-olds and even 40-year-olds with these drugs over a lifetime, with the risk of DKA being there, and one that, as I've suggested, can't be diminished. Even in studies in which they try to reduce the risk of DKA, they were having an increased risk of DKA. And currently, as the authors point out, there are meta-analyses as well, network meta-analyses. I mean, there are tons of these papers coming out that suggest that, sadly, we just have not done the correct study. Now, a study like that, as a clinical trial person, would require tens of thousands of people, because the event rates are going to be quite low in this generally younger, healthier, less likely to get heart disease in their mid-40s, even with their type 1. And the final thing I'd point out is that, of course, the intensive therapy, not only glycemic, which the DCCT and its follow-up have shown reduce heart disease substantially and by more than 50%, but of course the aggressive use of blood pressure meds and ARBs and ACE inhibitors and statins, et cetera, have reduced the rate of those outcomes. You'd have to study people for a long period of time, and many of them, in order to demonstrate the benefit. But currently, as the authors point out, there are no data to support that these are good. What we have is data over and over again suggesting they're harm, but I don't see the benefit.
As we move here towards the end, I do want to touch quickly on some of the author's limitations. So they do a good job of listing several of their limitations, some of which we've talked about already. So they do mention this is a limited sample. It's a pretty small size of a cohort here. There wasn't any matching. So we talked about quite a bit of baseline difference between these two groups. So they didn't do anything to address that. There was no matching that occurred here. There's no control group. We talked about that already. Medications were investigated by class, and that was because of the relatively small numbers. They had to lump those together. So we don't know if there's a difference between the type of medications within each of those classes. There's no data on glucose variability. I think this is important because we mentioned it before, but 25% of the individuals who were started on an SGLT2 inhibitor, that was done to try to limit glucose variability. And at least this report doesn't give us any information on that. Ashok mentioned already, but minority groups were underrepresented. There's also a possibility of documentation errors, confounding, and I'd say that's always an issue with observational studies. We've talked about this idea of insulin secretion and whether that could be an issue here. So the authors point out they didn't measure C-peptides here, so it's unclear if there's any folks who have meaningful residual insulin secretion or not, and whether that might make a difference. And then we've talked about these already. So where I'd like us to go next is to go through the author's conclusions. So I'll go through them, and there's three main ones here. So first of all, the authors state that GLP-1 receptor agonist and SGLT2 inhibitors may be beneficial in type 1 diabetes. They point out that DKA and other side effects do remain a concern. And finally, that we don't know about those cardiac and renal benefits. So where I'd like us to wrap up, I'll start with Ashok, and I'll get his thoughts. So just quality of the report overall. Well, we'll think about implications here in a second, and I'll put David on the hot seat again for that. But Ashok, why don't you just give us your thoughts about the quality of this report overall for what it is, an observational study.
So David started off by talking about the very severe limitations of any kind of a study that starts retrospectively with a very small sample size. And I think that remains very true, and that really clouds one's appreciation for work like this. I do have a lot of sympathy for people who undertake this kind of work, because it really is so very difficult to sort out, the wheat from the chaff of all the data that you see. So overall, I think it's a little helpful and maybe might prompt us to try to get some kind of a prospective study on selected phenotypes of patients with severe insulin deficiency, just to tease out what kind of benefits you get and try to get a risk-benefit ratio. And it gives us a little bit of a signal that it might be worth doing a study like that, although I'd like to get David's thoughts on this. But otherwise, I found this to be interesting. Now, a positive thing about the study is that many, many people ask this question. I mean, I frequently get questions from practicing endocrinologists or people in rural areas saying, okay, I keep hearing about the renal benefits and the cardiac benefits. Should I give it to my type 1 looking patients with it, right? And we don't have much data on that. And at least there is a modest data from something like this. So those are kind of my thoughts. I think David has a more expert view of this.
Firstly, no, I don't have a more expert view. I will say that despite the obvious limitations and frankly, the low quality data that these kinds of studies present, that the authors did, you know, they try to control all of the things they could. But you just can't address the intrinsic problems with this kind of data collection, and especially the small size of the study. The fact that this was presented here, selected by you, Chase, was going to be published in JCNM, a high-quality journal, is just a reflection of the thirst that endocrinologists have, a thirst that can't be slaked easily. And what I would like to have seen, and if this hasn't come out yet, of course, there hasn't been an editorial, but there should be an outcry that this demands an appropriately powered study, which unfortunately, of course, unless the companies, the pharma that makes these drugs, you know, wants to get them labeled specifically for type 1 diabetes, they have no motivation to do those studies. And these, as I said, would be extremely long duration, expensive studies with many, many participants, because they're looking at a slope of the trajectory of EGFR or albuminuria. Well, that's approachable. You could do that part of it. But looking at cardiac outcomes would be enormously expensive and difficult. It's a challenge. It's the kind of thing clinical trialists love to look at and think, you know, blackboard kind of considerations. You know, how would you do this? How many people would it take? But hopefully this will prompt people to do the studies that are more definitive, that answer the questions that are needed. We're all interested in helping our patients, clearly. And these drugs have been very powerful and helpful, we think, in helping with type 2 diabetes and even non-diabetes. Could we extend this to type 1?
Yeah, good, David. That's really helpful. And so telling us what information we need here. And you've also been pretty clear, I think, on your thoughts on SGLT2 inhibitors and folks with type 1 diabetes. But I'll leave one final question for you to end us today. And so as we think about those GLP-1, so in that situation, it does reduce weight. We've seen that in clinical trials. This supports that in real world. It's the same. So how about that? So should we be changing our practice now? Yeah, we need more information. We've got to have better studies that really inform us here. But for now, for the patient that I'm getting ready to go see in clinic this afternoon or tomorrow morning, should I be thinking about GLP-1s with the cost of those? We don't know about those other benefits that are seen in type 2 diabetes. Do you recommend that we change our practice now and be thinking about that? Or do we really need to wait until we have more information to really understand if these are beneficial for our folks with type 1 diabetes?
Well, as I said before, I think that the bar is somewhat lower for the GLP-1s because they don't carry this safety baggage that the SGLT inhibitors do. They do carry with them an enormous expense. So we shouldn't forget that. And I must say that I think that we as clinicians, we treat the patient in front of us, we do the best we can, but somewhere in the back of our heads, you know, we can't just leave it up to the patients to wonder if they can afford $1,000 per month, which may have enormous copays or may not be paid for at all or whatever. And using these drugs short-term gives you short-term results, and then people go right back to the weight they were. So, you know, I think we do need to consider the expense, but I think the bar, as I said before, is somewhat lower for the GLP-1 receptor agonists in terms of weight loss. That is a problem that plagues our patients. They don't like it. We don't like it. It's not good for their overall health. We're almost pretty sure, I think, and helping them lose weight would be great.
And with that, I would like to thank Ashok Balasubramaniam and David Nathan for joining me for this month's edition of Endocrine Feedback Loop. I learned a lot and know that you all did as well. Please join us again next month. And now you're in the loop. This has been Endocrine Feedback Loop. Endocrine Feedback Loop is brought to you as a members-only benefit of the Endocrine Society, with production oversight by Brandy Brown and Andrew Harmon.